Welcome to page 17. We are moving right along, talking about the beginning of life of Jesus, the infancy narratives that we find in the beginning of the Gospels of Luke and Matthew, and we're picking up on the presentation in the temple. So the timeline does get a little bit fuzzy here in, you know, the corresponding events of the nativity, the presentation in the temple, the flight to Egypt, and the arrival of the kings. But I'll tell you what we do know, and then different scholars have different ideas. Really, the truth is the gospel doesn't tell us exactly when things happen, how many days, how many months, how many years are in between things. So if you feel a little confused about like, well, when did the kings actually come and when did this happen? It's like, yeah, we all kind of accept that this book doesn't tell us every single detail, and it's okay to not know everything. Okay, so don't let it bother you. Okay, but moving into the presentation of the temple, this happens, we know for a fact, 40 or 40-ish days after Jesus's birth. So they give birth in Bethlehem, of course, in the manger, in the stable, and then 8 days after birth, the baby, the Hebrew boy, gets circumcised. So the presentation in the temple is not the circumcision. That would have already taken place according to Abrahamic law. Okay, so circumcision already happens. Here they go. They're going, according to Exodus 13:2, to redeem the firstborn and buy him back from God. You might think, what? What are we talking about? Buy him back from God? It's really this whole Old Testament thing that the firstborn son is the priest for the family. And that's kind of how priesthood was supposed to be and was originally established. We see that it kind of get messes up during the time of Moses. So people are enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And during that time, they kind of lose the priesthood of the firstborn. Makes sense. They're slaves. They're worshiping false idols. During the Passover, when God kills the firstborn of every person who doesn't have the Passover lamb blood over their door, you know, the angel of God passes over and does not do that 10th plague to the people who have the Passover done. The firstborn of Egypt are struck down, but at the same time, the firstborn of Israel are consecrated. So it's like they have this moment of re-taking on that priesthood, the firstborn, which is awesome. So we see just for a few short months, this kind of awesome, like, renewal of the firstborn son. They walk across that Red Sea, they're free, they head on up, they help Moses, the firstborn, the young men, they help Moses, like, I guess, do things to set up for the covenant. They have the covenant. And then, literally like 3 months after the Red Sea happens, they're at Sinai and the whole golden calf incident happens when the people started to worship the golden calf. Moses says to the people, who is with me? Who will come defend God's honor? Who will come, like, repent for what you've done? And he offers this moment of anybody helping him. And really what he's calling is he's calling the firstborn sons. He's calling the men who are consecrated to be priests for the nation of Israel. And they don't step up. Who steps up is, you know, Moses's brothers, his uncles, his cousins, the Levite tribe. The Levites, up to this point in history, had no reason to be priests. So the Levites become priests because of their allegiance to Moses and to God in this moment in Exodus 32. So the Levitical priesthood is kind of like this whole plan B that God has for priesthood. Plan A was always the firstborn son. What does that have to do with this is that according to Exodus 13:2, now they have to go redeem their firstborn and buy him back from God because the Levites are the ones taking on the priesthood. The firstborn sons are not, but the firstborn sons are still consecrated to God. So in order that they are not priests, they kind of, you know, the practice is they go, the family with the firstborn son goes and they pay the priest to say, thank you for doing the job that my firstborn son should have done. But a long time ago, it all got screwed up. Okay, so it's like a ceremonial thing, but they're supposed to exchange money. The Holy Family is supposed to give 5 shekels. Interestingly enough, I'm only pointing this out because the Holy Family doesn't do it. Okay, they do not buy Jesus back. This is them completely giving him to God. They're not buying him back. It's interesting. It's like a very symbolic thing, which really gets passed over in the presentation of the temple because we focus a lot on Anna and Simeon, who we'll talk about in a moment, and on, you know, the turtle doves and different things. But the price for the redemption of the firstborn does not pass from the Holy Family to the priests. And Luke goes into a lot of detail and it doesn't include that detail. So you have to assume it's because that detail did not happen. Now, interestingly enough, they don't have to go to the temple in Jerusalem to do this. They are showing extra piety, extra faithfulness. They can do this, I guess, locally, but they go to Jerusalem. They're not too far away, but still. Pope Benedict XVI in Jesus of Nazareth, he says, Evidently, Luke intends to say that instead of being redeemed and restored to his parents, this child was personally handed over to God in the temple, given over completely to God. Luke has nothing to say regarding this act of redemption prescribed by the law. In its place, we find the exact opposite. The child is handed over to God, and from now on, he belongs to him completely. So that's from Jesus of Nazareth. That's Pope Benedict talking about how the Holy Family actually didn't redeem Jesus when they actually should have. Now, let's get to the more action items of the presentation of the temple. One of the biggest things that happens is that they meet Anna and Simeon. Anna and Simeon are a prophetess and a prophet, respectively, and they're there in the temple because they're looking for the Messiah. They don't do this just like every single day of their lives. This time, the time that Jesus is coming, has messianic fervor, meaning the people think, large groups of people, large sects of Judaism, think that the Messiah is coming now. It's kind of an expectation. There's kind of a stir, a buzz, that around this time, any time now, we should see the Messiah coming. So these two prophet and prophetess, old, they're aged, they come every single day to the temple to see if they can see him. Okay, they probably haven't been doing this their whole lives. It's probably like because they're in the time frame that they actually expect him now. The time frame, by the way, comes from the book of Daniel. Daniel prophesies that the Messiah will come in like 500 years. And so it's 500 years later and they're looking for him and they find him and they have eyes to see him, that he's a baby, and they recognize him, which is pretty cool. Simeon tells Mary that, of course, she's going to have her heart pierced, and has this prophecy for her that must have been really difficult for her to accept and understand. But that is that. And then second thing, the turtle doves. The turtle doves are the sacrifice for the poorest of the poor. So the most expensive sacrifice, we may have mentioned earlier when we were talking about Luke, is an oxen. That's like the best sacrifice to give. But if you can't afford it, you can give like, say, a lamb or a goat. If you can't afford that, you can give, say, like a cat. That's probably not true. I'm just making it up. You see what I'm saying? There's like a scale. But the very biggest is the oxen and the very smallest is the two turtle doves. And we see that the Holy Family is so poor that all they can give is two turtle doves. Now, they're not giving these two turtle doves to redeem Jesus. Like I said, that's 5 shekels that they don't give. They're giving 2 turtle doves as a payment for the ritual cleansing of Mary. The mother has to be cleansed after the birth of the baby. 33 days to 40 days after. She can't enter the sanctuary to worship until she's been cleansed. She's got to go into a mikvah, which is a bath, to be cleansed. No menstruating women are allowed near the Temple Mount. They've got to wait, and then once they finish bleeding, then they can go take their bath. So she enters the sanctuary to worship, according to Leviticus 12, only after she has her bath, which is just, you got to think about the irony. It's like, the most pure woman in the entire world, sinless, perfect, and she's getting purified? Like, what? The humility of Mary, it's crazy. But anyways, they pay their payment, the 2 turtle doves, actually not for Jesus, but for Mary. According to Leviticus 12:8, if you want to write that over in the Old Testament side, that's where it says the turtle doves. And that's why they go to the temple. Like I said, they actually didn't have to be in the temple. They just had to go probably to a synagogue. The mikvahs are actually outside of the temple, because obviously you can't go inside unclean. You got to be cleaned outside. But yeah, this is showing that the Holy Family is following Mosaic law. They're not like, oh my gosh, we have the Savior. We don't have to do anything. Jesus is raised Jewish. The Holy Family practices the Jewish traditions and ceremonial practices. They do it. They do the lifestyle things up until Jesus obviously develops his own religion and completes Judaism by becoming, you know, he is the Messiah. Anyways, that's a lot on the presentation of the temple, and you only had a little bit of space to write. I apologize. We're going to move on to the flight to Egypt, okay? This is where the timeline gets, it's tricky, because the flight to Egypt happens because when the wise men come to visit Jesus, they accidentally tell Herod and endanger Jesus's life. And then Herod, who we talked about earlier, Herod the Great, he's paranoid, so he orders a mass massacre of all the baby boys in the region. Now, he doesn't order the baby boys massacred in Nazareth. He orders them in Bethlehem. Okay, so the wise men are coming to Bethlehem. Herod orders the massacre of all babies 2 and under, which tells you that there's a couple year gap here that might have happened. We don't actually know when the wise men came. And the Holy Family was found in Bethlehem by the wise men. But if they went back to Nazareth, then they wouldn't have been found. So you have to wonder, did they stay in Bethlehem for an extended period of time? I mean, Joseph probably has tons of relatives in Bethlehem. Maybe they just thought we're supposed to stay in Bethlehem. Micah 5 prophecy says that Bethlehem's the place the Savior's going to come from. You know what I'm saying? So we don't know all the different things, but we do know that the wise men did show up in Jerusalem looking for the baby king. They found him. They presented gifts. Herod ordered a murdering. Joseph was warned in a dream to take Mary and Jesus and flee to Egypt. And they did flee to Egypt. Okay. So at some unspecified point, before 12 years old, they returned to Nazareth. We believe it's probably from the death of King Herod. When that death is announced, I believe it's in 4 BC that he dies. Then they're like, okay, we're safe and we can go back. So do you see how Jesus was probably not born actually in 0 AD? He was probably born a little bit earlier, 6 BC. Okay, so in the Old Testament category, this beginning of life story, this infancy story of Jesus should remind us of the story of Moses, okay? Moses was also born into a massacre of little boys. The Pharaoh at the time was very nervous about the growth of the Hebrews, and so he ordered a massacre of the little boys, and they were all supposed to be thrown in the Nile. Moses' mother kept him safe by putting him in a basket in the Nile and pushing him down towards the Pharaoh. So by pushing him towards Egypt, right? Now, they were in Egypt in the first place, but still, he fled to Egypt and was spared during the massacre of boys. Jesus fled to Egypt and was spared during the massacre of boys. Okay. Also, in Hosea 11:1, there's a prophecy. You can put this in the Old Testament side. Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I have called my son. Now, Jesus acts as the new Israel. So in the Old Testament, God uses firstborn language, like Israel, the nation, is his firstborn son. But Jesus also is his firstborn son, okay? So it can be both and. So this prophecy about Israel is also about Jesus. And Jesus is called out of Egypt, back into the promised land, to grow, have his hidden years in Nazareth, and then eventually to do his ministry. Okay, from the flight to Egypt to being lost in the temple, we don't get a lot of details, okay? We get a little story about when he's 12 years old, he's lost in the temple, and then we don't get any more information about him, that's called the hidden years, until he starts his ministry. So this story of being lost in the temple is kind of like, wow, nice, we get a little insight in his life, okay? So here's what happens in getting lost in the temple. First of all, they go to Jerusalem again from Nazareth, so they're, you know, again, just like they did for Bethlehem, they're walking multiple days, 4 to 7 days. They're in a caravan with family and friends, and they go down to Jerusalem for the Passover. They do this every year. It's an annual feast. It got lost in tradition for a little bit near the beginning of conquering the Promised Land, but it was brought back by Josiah. It was lost again, brought back by Ezra. So there's been a patchy, like, annual feast, but it is an annual feast for the last, at least, while before Jesus comes. Okay, so he will go to Jerusalem for Passover again and have dinner in the upper room in like 16 years, okay? Because he's 12, I don't know, when he's like gonna die, his last meal is gonna be there. And I wonder, you know, I like to think, is he like 12 years old looking at the upper room, seeing it, seeing the window and saying, I know it's gonna happen there. Like, does he know all that yet? But anyways, here he is. They journey back home without him, thinking that he's with them, and he's lost for 3 days, and they run on back to Jerusalem, and they find him in the temple, and he asks them, you know, why are you looking for me? Don't you know I'm supposed to stay here in my father's house? Now, there's a story in the Old Testament that's very interesting here in 1 Samuel 1:25-28. Hannah, who we talked about earlier, Hannah, who has the beautiful Magnificat-like song, she was a barren woman who begged God for a child. She had the Samuel, and then she gave her son Samuel to the temple, and he grew up among the priests. She dropped him off as soon as he was old enough. And it's possible that maybe Jesus thinks this is going to happen to him. Like, just like Samuel before him, he is consecrated to God. He was not redeemed back. He's going to grow up in the temple. So it's interesting, Luke sees the similarity, Luke the gospel writer, and he uses the same words to describe Samuel and Jesus. The words increased in wisdom and stature and in favor of God and man describes Samuel in the Old Testament, and those are the exact words that Luke uses in Luke 2:52 to describe Jesus growing up. So Luke sees the connection, right? Mary essentially says, no, it's not time, and she takes him back home, and that leads us to the hidden years. The hidden years are undocumented years. We don't know much about them. We only know what we can infer because we know a lot about, like, Jewish culture of the time, and so we can assume and put together pieces of what we know Jesus' life might have looked like, but we don't know any details here. These are the hidden years. So He's 13 to 30 years old during this time. Joseph probably died sometime in the hidden years when Mary became a widow, because we know that Joseph would have been at the foot of his son's cross if he was alive then, so he must have died sometime in there. He's never mentioned again in Jesus' public ministry, even though Mary is. Jesus probably, I mean, he definitely went to rabbi school because he's a rabbi, and he would have spoken Hebrew and Aramaic. Interestingly, usually if you go to rabbi school, you become a rabbi. You don't take the trade of your father. So here is Jesus taking the trade of his father. He's also a carpenter. So that's kind of unusual that he does both. He doesn't go under a mentor rabbi, a famous rabbi like most people would. That's kind of what you do. You go to rabbi school and you join under a very famous rabbi and you kind of get street cred that way to build your rabbi career. Jesus didn't do that. He went home and became a carpenter. Over in the Old Testament, David was a shepherd boy when he was anointed to be the next king of Israel, and then he had to live as a shepherd boy for a while longer before he actually became king. David had his own hidden years, okay? As a matter of fact, just in general, you can write in the Old Testament, waiting. There's a lot of waiting. God promises something, and then there's waiting. So it's like, here comes the Messiah, but we're going to wait until the fullness of time for him to come out and do something. Think about the people in the desert. Think about Abraham. He's getting the promises, but he has to wait. So it gives us a lot to think about in terms of our own lives, that God sanctifies the ordinary by living the ordinary. You know, he doesn't come and get to work at age 7 years old, starting to heal people and baptize people and spread his message far and wide. He waits and he lives a normal human life, and he lives in humility and obscurity. So much that when he starts his public ministry, people are like, I know that guy. He's just my neighbor. He's not God. What? And so, yeah, crazy. God's timing is not our own timing. Okay, next page is exciting because it's about the temple. So let's move on to page 18, and we're going to talk all about the temple.